good afternoon to you on this blustery Friday afternoon here in Juneau. I'm Andy Klein, your host for a Juneau afternoon. Today we're going to have four guests come in. We'll first talk to Ernestine Hayes about her Friday night evening at Egan presentation on An Animated World. She's got a lot going on. We'll talk to her about all that stuff. Rhonda Gardner is here to talk about Saturday's Zippity-Doo-Dah concert. Carl Hine will be here to highlight the Front Street Community Health Center's first Friday open house. And we'll talk with Mike Lucas from the Mendenhall Flying Lions Club about this Saturday's benefit barbecue for the Alaska Diabetes Association. That's all happening. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music and more coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Obama addressed the Tribal Nations Conference Thursday in Washington, D.C., but in a departure from his past addresses to tribal leaders, this time he took questions from a panel of young people. Matt Laszlo reports.
At past Tribal Nation conferences, President Obama delivered speeches to tribal leaders. Not this time. He sat down for a panel discussion with young Alaska Natives and Native Americans. The first black president of the U.S. told the youth that being a minority should be viewed as a means of empowerment and not something anyone should hide from.
It's not a betrayal of your traditions to understand those tools and use them on behalf of your community and on behalf of yourself.
Obama was asked about how tribes can tackle childhood obesity, while others asked about getting running water. The president agreed more resources are needed, but he said Congress needs to grapple with the question.
How do we give tribes the tools whereby they can start generating jobs and economic development and progress on their own terms within their communities?
The president deferred to the panel of students on many questions, like on how to combat the high rate of suicides in Indian country, but no definitive initiative was proposed in the meeting. I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The U.S. Department of Justice is suing the South Dakota Department of Social Services for alleged discriminatory hiring practices. The complaint was filed this week in federal court. Victoria Wicks reports.
The case started in 2010 when DSS listed a vacancy at Pine Ridge for an employment specialist. That employee assists people receiving benefits to get jobs. According to the complaint, Cedric Goodman and four other Native people applied for the job along with one white applicant. Goodman had the education and experience called for, including a bachelor's degree, 30 hours toward a master's degree, 5 years of social work, and 4 years as an employment specialist. After conducting interviews, DSS closed the vacancy but reopened it the following day and ended up hiring a white female recent college graduate with no applicable experience. The complaint charges DSS with a pattern of discrimination, hiring non-Indians for higher-paying specialist jobs and Native people for lesser-paying jobs. DOJ says DSS uses arbitrary and subjective decision-making to reject Native applicants in favor of non-Native applicants. A 2-year review of DSS practices indicates 92% of hires for specialist positions were white and 8% or one person was Native. DOJ charges that DSS closes positions rather than hiring qualified Native applicants. The relief sought includes that DSS stop discriminating and adopt a selection process that complies with federal employment law. Other sanctions include putting Goodman in the next employment specialist job that comes open at Pine Ridge and awarding back pay and other damages to applicants. DSS has not yet filed a response. I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Petroglyphs are the focus of a festival this weekend in Southern California, which includes tours, a film showcase, and a powwow. Christina Onnestead has more.
The ancient Native American rock writings date back 10,000 years, and the Ridgecrest Petroglyph Festival is celebrating them. Doug Luke, the executive director of the Ridgecrest Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, which is the lead organizer of the event, says for the first time they'll offer tours of the petroglyphs.
They're actually all over the valley, but the main cluster is on the Navy Weapons Center, and there's the biggest concentration of petroglyphs in the Western Hemisphere. It's on our base.
Luke says the tours are aimed at educating the public about indigenous people, including the 9 Native American tribes in the region. Luke says last year an estimated 15,000 people attended. He expects a similar large turnout this year. Christina Onnestead, National Native News, California.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Support provided by Shoshone Bannock Tribal Farms, proud producer of free-range, sustainable buffalo jerky. Holiday delivery of original, peppered, and teriyaki buffalo jerky available on orders placed by December 15th. More information at sbtribalfarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Support comes from Alaska Island Community Services. If you're a parent and you smoke, here's what one child has to say about this.
I wish you'd quit smoking because there's so much of my life I want you to be a part of, like taking me to wrestling practice, teaching me to throw baseball for Little League, catching my first derby fish, watching me graduate from high school, and watching my kids, your grandchildren, grow and play. I wish you would stop smoking because there's so much both of us will miss out on.
This message brought to you by the Partnership for Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
And welcome back to the KTO studios. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today's Juno Afternoon, and with me now is Ernestine Hayes. Ernestine, thanks so much for joining us again here on Juno Afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
You're busy. You're a busy woman right now.
I'm busy. Yeah.
So let's talk first and foremost about the event that's happening tonight. You've got a lecture happening at evening at Egan. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to be talking about.
Well, this will probably be one of my last opportunities to read from this book, Blonde Indian, and so I plan to read some passages and then talk about the theme, which is everything is alive and we are all part of a song.
So tell me a little bit more about that theme. That's a beautiful sentiment, but tell me how you arrived at that and how that's become a focus.
Well, the fact that everything is alive is a simple truth, and it's something that it's easy to forget, ignore, or perhaps sometimes not even be aware of because of the schooling and other things that sort of cloud our vision. But we know that everything is connected, everything has life, everything has spirit and energy, and this is a simple, basic truth that I believe everyone knows.
So when you say, when you're talking about, tell me a little bit more about what you're talking about there, that there's a, do you feel that there's an energy that everything has, even what we might consider inanimate objects or artifacts or things that were once created but now are just sitting on a table, that kind of, you know, what, or how do you go about describing that?
Well, in my understanding, of course, everything develops a spirit and energy. Energy collects, energy exists, and everything has a spirit about it. I'm sure you've, you know, walked past a house where you thought, you know, or into a room and you can feel something, the energy or the spirit of that place. And then, of course, everything lives, everything has life, everything contains meaning. These are understood commonly to be an indigenous way of seeing the world. But in my understanding, my feeling is that this isn't so much an indigenous way of seeing the world as it is a human way of seeing the world. It's not only indigenous people who can see that everything is connected. We can all see that. Humans can see that everything is connected and interdependent. That's a human way of seeing the world.
And this idea that everything is connected, how does it manifest itself in how you live your life?
Well, this is something I have that I was taught, and I wasn't taught in the sense that, you know, I was sent to school and I sat in a wooden chair and the teacher, you know, wrote something on the blackboard. I was taught this by my grandmother describing the world to me. So it's not necessarily something that I need to think about or read about or remind myself about, because this is how the world was described to me when I was a child, and so this is how I see the world.
Mm-hmm. So is that a focus? So that's an idea behind inanimate world. Is that also some of the focus of Blonde Indian?
Yes,
it is. So yes. Tell me a little bit about how it connects to that work as well.
Well, you asked me earlier.
And yeah, if you'd like to read a passage, that'd be great. We'd love to hear it.
This is a passage that pretty much articulates that, and it's something that Jonas Lamb, who is coordinating all these events and set them up and is wrangling them.
and wrangling you a little bit.
And chose to quote this on the Facebook page, and so I'll read it.
Okay.
Remember that the land is inspirited. It is quickened. When, as you conduct your life, you chance to see an eagle or a wolf or a bear, remember that it too is conducting its life, and it sees you as well, as does a tree and the forest itself. The very land sees you. When you remember this and feel this and know this, you will want to hug the land. You will want to embrace it. And when that happens, you can be sure that the land feels the same way about you. The land loves you. She misses her children.
Well, that's wonderful. That's a wonderful, thank you for reading that. I appreciate it very much. So tell me a little bit about about what you hope to have people take away from the talk tonight at Evening at Egan.
Well, I'm reading the introduction and the conclusion that I just read, and a few passages from the middle of the book. And there's I hope to construct a metaphor about some of the nature writing that is contained in the book, and talk about the songs that we sing today, and construct a metaphor about a certain phenomenon and a series of events in nature, and that in my mind reflect our current experience.
Well, that's going to be a lot to accomplish, right? But that's a wonderful thing and a great way to spend a rainy evening here in Juneau, to go and kind of consider those things and listen to the point of view you have on that. Now, let's talk a little bit about just a couple of the other events that are happening around some of the stuff that you've done. One is that there's a UAS Blonde Indian Book Club. Tell me about what that's about.
Well, I was fortunate enough so that my book, Blonde Indian, was selected as this year's One Campus, One Book selection, which means that the incoming students, the freshman students, the first-year students at UAS, receive a copy of my book. And then there's various events, and I visit classes and so on. And then apart from that, there's also staff and faculty book club and students if they wish, and some readers who want to simply get together and maybe talk about certain aspects of the book.
That's great. And then there's also, you've got a writing workshop coming up.
Yes, a week from Saturday at the new library, and I'll be doing a writing workshop, a memoir workshop, which will be mainly exercises and quick prompts and some fun things to do that we can write together and share.
And if people want to get registered for that, they can go to libraryevents@juno.org, or they can also call 586-0434. That's libraryevents@juno.org to get signed up for the writing workshop that's happening on November 14th. It's going to be running from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. So not a gigantic chunk of the day, but a nice 3-hour time period to really work through some exercises, as you say, and get a little bit of your perspective on writing and on what it
right.
takes to
I have
to
some
do it.
Good tips that I share with my students, so I'll be sharing some of those.
Can you tell us one, maybe just a preview, one of the tips that you
my
try to
favorite
give to people?
Is something I call privileged position. And I tell all my students, this is what I would share if I sat on a plane with someone I'll never see again, and that is at the end of every sentence, every paragraph, every section, every chapter, every book, the last words are what the reader remembers and takes with them into the next section or into their lives. For the easiest purpose is to remember that for the end of every paragraph. So end every paragraph on a strong image that you want the reader to take with them to the next paragraph. Don't end your paragraph on something like that was the end of it and the door shut. Give us an image. Give us your strongest image and make a sound, construct a color, a sense, something that the reader will experience and want to keep reading.
That's wonderful advice. Ernestine Hayes, An Animate World, and it's going to be an intimate evening, and An Animate World is going to be happening tonight, 7 o'clock, evening at Egan. That's at the UAS Egan Library. And then the UAS Blonde Indian Book Club is happening all starting November 11th through December 2nd, and the meetings are held 3 Wednesdays, is that right? In Egan room 115 from noon to 1, so you can come all out and spend an hour there talking about this, and that's a really interesting opportunity to speak with, to be reading a book and then be able to speak to the person who wrote the book. I mean, that's an incredibly, that's a great experience. And then the Art of Memoir, that's a writing workshop you're going to be doing on November 14th, and people can sign up for that if they want by going to libraryevents@juno.org and sending a note that you want to be a part of that. Ernestine Hayes, thanks so much for your time here today.
Thank you very much.
I think it's more than appropriate that we should go next to Garrison Keillor's Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, November the 6th, 2015. It was on this day, 1860, Abraham Lincoln was elected President of the United States. He'd served only one term in Congress. He'd lost a race for the U.S. Senate, but he'd impressed people with his performance in a series of debates against Stephen Douglas in that race for the Senate in 1858. Got the Republican nomination for president, and thereafter barely campaigned at all. His strategy was to keep quiet. His opposition to slavery was well known. He'd given his House Divided speech, saying a house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. And in the wee hours of the morning of November 7th, 1860, he got word in Springfield, Illinois, that he had been elected with 40% of the popular vote. Abraham Lincoln, who said, "I'm a slow walker, but I never walk back. Give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, and I will spend the first 4 sharpening the axe." It's the birthday of John Philip Sousa, born Washington, D.C. 1854, joined the United States Marine Band at the age of 13, eventually became its leader, and composed the Marines' official march, Semper Fidelis. It was on Christmas Day, 1896, he composed the Stars and Stripes Forever. He was a hard worker, Sousa. He never retired, died suddenly of a heart attack after a rehearsal at the age of 78. And it's the birthday of the man who said, if you can't be funny, be interesting. Harold Ross, founder of the New Yorker magazine, born Aspen, Colorado, 1892. Founded the magazine in 1925, was proud of the fact that the New Yorker achieved a paid circulation of 400,000 without actively soliciting subscriptions. He attracted great writers around him, James Thurber, Ring Lardner, A.J. Liebling, Charles Adams, the cartoonist, E.B. White as well. Here's a poem for today by Jane Hirschfield, My Life Was the Size of My Life. My life was the size of my life. Its rooms were room-sized. Its soul was the size of a soul. In its background, mitochondria hummed. Above it, sun, clouds, snow, the transit of stars and planets. It rode elevators, bullet trains, various airplanes, a donkey. It wore socks, shirts, its own ears and nose. It ate, it slept, it opened and closed its hands, its windows. Others, I know, had lives larger. Others, I know, had lives shorter. The depth of lives, too, is different. There were times my life and I made jokes together. There were times we made bread. Once I grew moody and distant, I told my life I would like some time. I would like to try seeing others. In a week, my empty suitcase and I returned. I was hungry then, and my life too, was hungry. We could not keep our hands off, our clothes on, our tongues from. A poem by Jane Hirschfield, My Life Was the Size of My Life, from her collection The Beauty, published by Knopf and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days. Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine in my way.
Well, we're going to hear about a zippity-doo-dah concert coming next. Rhonda Gardner is here. Rhonda, thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
And tell me a little bit, you are going to do this song.
We are.
Zippity-doo-dah, but a different, much different version.
Much different version. and it's going to, it's not going to definitely not have that deep of a voice coming from me, at least. And we will all be on ukuleles. So right there. Different.
That'll be fun.
It is. It's actually, you were laughing at me about this being me doing it to myself. I didn't do this. Actually, zippity-doo-dah occurred long before I got to co-op preschool. And it was named, and I don't even know if it was when Linda Torgerson was there or before Linda got there, but the whole idea is at the end of the concert, everybody puts on their coats because they're going to play their zippers along with the song, and they zippity-doo-dah up their coat and scootle out the door.
That's funny.
So, you know, we're all about transition
yes.
at preschool, you know, helping them.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the concert, about the preschool and all that stuff. So first of all, tell me about the concert. When's it happening and all that, and kind of what can people expect?
Well, this is going to be tomorrow morning, and it's going to be from 11 in the morning until noon. And it has gone through many manifestations over the years. So anybody who hasn't been to Zippity Doodah in the past year or so, this is not the big extravaganza that it sort of behemoth grew into. All well-intentioned people that, hey, let's also do this and let's also add that. And it kind of got away from just the show. So and we want it to be for, you know, preschoolers.
Yeah.
So an hour is just about right. So we're going to do, we're going to start off with some music from the Hopkins Family Band, you know, Henry Hopkins over at the high school. And so he and his son Eric, who is an alumni from preschool,
very cool.
And Sarah will be getting up and playing some music and singing some songs. And then Lily Hudson Hope, who is also a preschool mom, her son Lewis is now with us, and she's going to get up and tell some stories, which I always love. That's actually sometimes I get to pick people who I want to hear, that's kind of nice. and then after Lily, we have another current preschool mom who is bringing along her belly dancing troupe. The Daughters of the New Moon are going to get up and hey, I mean, you know, if you're 4 years old, what don't you like about sparkly, jingly music?
Noise,
you know?
Yeah. And dancing and action and
motion.
And
I'm sure, I don't know if they're prepared, but I think they might get some audience participation. So I hope I hope they're ready because I think there might be some help.
I'm sure they would encourage that.
I'm hoping. Yes. I'm hoping for it. You know, I'm looking forward to that. And then my old colleague at the library, Carol Race, is going to be coming and telling a story.
Oh,
great.
Which
will be fun. And I love Carol's stories as well. And then I don't know if Carol's a preschool alumni mom. She might be.
I don't know.
I have to find out.
Guys,
yeah,
sure.
Maybe. Anyway. And then my gang with the Juno Jambusters ukulele band is, and the band in quotation marks means whoever from the jam shows up is in the band. So anybody out there who, you know, wants to contact me with their ukulele, I'll send them the music and they can be in the band. And we just have some sing-alongs for the kids to dance and do.
Very fun. And it all goes towards the
Juno Co-op Preschool.
And tell me a little bit about what's happening with the preschool.
We are, for people who don't know, we're a non-profit parent-teacher cooperative, and we have a Tuesday-Thursday morning class and a Monday-Wednesday-Friday morning class, and we've been going for a gazillion years, well, at least since, I think, like the early 60s. And we are a preschool so that we really just are focusing on, you know, helping the kids work with social-emotional connections and sort of their first experience for a lot of them away from home and working through all the things you have to work through when you're with another, you know, 15 to 18 kids your age. So.
But there's you know, I was talking to a preschool teacher just not long ago, and they were sort of talking about curriculum, and I kind of realized I had never really thought it, even when I had a child in preschool, I never really thought through that there's a real, that there's very concrete goals, right? And there's curriculum and there's, you know, exercise, all that stuff. It's not just, hey, the kid's safe and happy for the day and then that's it.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually, in a way, I kind of feel like if you can't see the curriculum, that might be okay.
Sure.
You might be doing a good job.
Yeah.
But, and what we, at least our philosophy at Co-op is that really most of what kids are learning, they're learning through play. And we're putting out things available for them to explore. And, you know, we certainly have, like, you know, we've had bones out for before Halloween and talked about bodies. And we bring in bear skins and we, you know, do stuff, cooking project with berries and on. So there is, you know, curriculum-ish stuff. But mostly they come and play and explore those activities based on their interest. And then they play, you know. I mean, most of them would rather be a bear.
Yeah.
Then look at it. Well, no, that's not true. They're probably both.
Both.
But a lot of, they've really enjoyed picking up. We have fish and wildlife, or fish and game bear skins, bear pelts, and they like getting
So, what are some of the highlight days at the preschool when you think about through the year? What are some of the big, that sounds like one, I'm sure, the day when the bear hides come in and stuff and all that. But
yeah, you know, it's funny. We sometimes, actually, like Halloween was a big deal, but my favorite part of Halloween is we have this little sheets of paper that have just a silhouette of a tree and a fence, and then mm-hmm. another piece of paper that has a silhouette of a house, kind of a haunted
mm-hmm.
house. And then we have these little cutouts of fabric, you know, witches and ghosts and bones and pumpkins and owls and things, and glue. And then they just sit down and they start gluing things onto this sheet, and then we say, well, tell us the story. And then you write down the story of what they've just done, and that's curriculum, that's literacy.
Yeah.
You know, they're seeing words from their head get put down on paper, and then we read it back later. But to me, for them, you know, the highlight's not really an event so much as these little things where these kids just get this, oh, that's, you know, I made a story. You
right,
know,
because I did when they're constructing that, they definitely are thinking of a narrative in their head.
Oh, yeah.
Right? They're
oh,
thinking
yeah.
about this is happening at this, and oh. I'm putting the cat here because of all that stuff.
And we miss all the good stuff.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
right.
Oh, there's so much going on in their head that we never know.
Right.
And that's the good stuff, you know. So the trick is just trying to help them, you know, figure out different ways to express
yeah.
all of that. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, that's all
yeah.
happening at the Juno Co-op Preschool. Happens there 5 days a week, right?
Well, I'm there 3 days a week.
Okay.
I'm Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Mary Sweeney's there 5 days a
okay.
week, and Kathleen Nyson is the Tuesday, Thursday.
Okay, cool. Yeah, yeah, so that's all happening there all the time. And is enrollment full, or is there
enrollment's not full right now.
Opportunities if people are looking, yeah?
Yep, there are some spaces. I think I probably shouldn't even name numbers because it's always in flux, but I think there's probably about 5 spaces in Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and a couple in Tuesday, Thursday.
Okay.
And we have subspots. The family, you know, it's you know, parents volunteer to do work days there, and they have family jobs, and it's trickier
mm-hmm.
with 2 families working these days. And so people can be subs. They can come and, you know, when somebody's on vacation or sick, then we can call the sub list, and they don't have to have work days, the parents, and they don't have to have a family job, but their kids can come on occasion.
I see. Yeah.
So there's some options out
right.
there. Yeah.
Well, that's happening at the Juno Co-op Preschool, and then tomorrow at 11 o'clock, going from 11 to noon, the Zippity Doo Dah concert. Where is it again? Okay.
It's upstairs at the Northern Light Church.
Okay.
So preschool is in the basement, and
yep.
it's going to be upstairs. Yeah.
Okay. And that's Northern Lights Church down there on 11th Street,
yep.
12th
what?
And 11th, kind of
yep.
right between the two there.
Yep.
And you're going to be hearing it. Zippity Doo Dah, right?
That's
gonna
it.
It's going to be going.
Yeah.
It's going to be fun.
Okay.
All right. We'll have fun.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Rhonda. That's happening tomorrow, 11 to noon.
Yes, sir. Zippity Doo Dah, zippity yay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, plenty of sunshine in the wind.
Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It's the truth, mm-hmm. it's actual.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is satisfactory. Zip-a-dee-doo-dah, zip-a-dee-ay. Wonderful feeling this way. Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It is the truth. It's actual. Huh? Why is that bluebird? Mm-hmm. Everything is satisfied. Zip-a-dee-ay. Wonderful feeling. Wonderful day.
All right, I've had enough of that song. That's Zippity Doo Dah there. And that's going to be a concert happening 11 to noon tomorrow over at the Northern Lights Church in conjunction with the Juno Co-op Preschool that's over there. In the studio with me now is Carl Hine from the Front Street Community Health Center. And, Carl, you've got a First Friday open house going on in just a couple of, like, about an hour here,
about
right?
An hour, yes.
Right, at 4:30 this afternoon it's going to be starting. Telling me a little bit about why you guys decided to do an open house.
Sure. So the Front Street Community Health Center, as you know, is the is a medical clinic for homeless and low-income folks that don't have access to health care anywhere else. We've struggled in the last year with some temporary providers, and we have now got a permanent nurse practitioner to help take care of our patients. And we felt that having an open house and introducing the community to our new nurse practitioner and letting community members see the clinic and the resources that we have there would be a great thing to do. And we figured doing it in conjunction with a First Friday when people are downtown and wandering around would be a good opportunity to have an open house and get people to see the clinic and meet Cindy. So.
Tell me about the new nurse practitioner that you
have.
Sure. Yeah.
So Cindy Mattoni is she's a nurse practitioner. She's from Cleveland, but she worked in Wrangell for a while and worked for us for a while this summer doing some fill-in work. We've had fill-in locum providers for the last several months trying to keep the clinic doors open, and she was doing that for a while for us and decided that she liked the clinic enough and loves Southeast Alaska that she was taken by the beauty.
Even on
of
days like today, huh?
On days like today, the beauty of the place
is always
is,
the key. Yeah,
right. it's harder to appreciate it on days like today than last week when it was sunny.
It is. That's true. Yeah, but yes, so. we all of us who live here understand our relationship with this place. Yeah. But tell me a little bit more about the mission of the Front Street Community Health Center. And I know that there's changes on the horizon or potential changes on the horizon as well as far as location and new facility and that kind of stuff.
Sure. So the Front Street Community Health Center has been a homeless clinic, and for about 10 years it was run by Search. And Search, a couple of years ago, decided that it wasn't really part of their mission and they wanted to get out of that business. A number of us that were concerned about the needs of the patient population that were met by the clinic got together and started a new organization, have our own 501c3, and kind of kept the clinic doors open. Our funding is largely through a federal grant, a HRSA grant, but we've also had some state grants and state monies, and we were able to raise a large chunk of money to help us do the initial transition from Search. And we were kind of doing okay for a while there, but with the having to hire temporary providers and some other issues, we were a bit behind on our budget. So one of the other things we're doing right now is a fundraising drive.
So what does that look like?
Sure. Yeah. So we trying to fill a budget hole and trying to get a little bit of a cushion so that, you know, we don't have to worry about paying rent every month, that we have the money in the bank. We're raising a goal of $100,000. We have a $50,000 match from Northern Light Church, and that's been wonderful. Mm-hmm. And we've been working at getting the $50,000 to meet their match for a little bit now, but want to hit that fundraising goal by the end of the year.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to think about. Every dollar that you contribute is actually turned into $2.
That is correct.
Matching grant. That's a
that
really
is correct.
Yeah.
And the generosity of the Northern Light Church is just wonderful. We really want to thank them.
Is there a specific reason why they in particular got involved?
The folks at Northern Light seem to have a strong sense of, you know, community and social justice and helping those in need. And I think that's, you know, part of their kind of culture to that church, and that certainly is our mission, is providing health care to folks that don't have health care in another manner.
Mm-hmm.
The clinic initially, and when Search was running it, was an exclusively a homeless clinic. So, you know, you had to be homeless to be able to get your care at the Front Street Clinic. We are continuing to serve the homeless, but we're not restricting it to homeless. So we'll actually see anybody, but we really are a clinic that focuses on low-income homeless people that don't have access to health care anywhere else.
Are there things that you in particular see with that population? Are there things that you're dealing with more often than other things or that you're prepared for?
Certainly. And the challenges of homelessness and you often see medical issues in conjunction with substance abuse issues or mental health and behavioral health issues. And so one of the things that the clinic has had in the past was a, with a trifecta of services with medical care, mental health care, and dental care. We've kind of had to contract a bit, and we're struggling trying to find a way to provide dental care. That seems to be a really challenging thing to fund and finance. We have temporarily stopped having behavioral health, but we've now got another expansion grant that will cover behavioral health, so we're getting that back in. And that's a really important service for our patients, as many of the patients have both medical and behavioral health issues. The medical issues are the common chronic disease issues, diabetes, seizure disorder, hypertension, that sort of stuff. And it's important that folks get those kinds of basic care needs met because it keeps people from having more serious problems. If you treat people's hypertension, then they don't have heart disease and strokes as much. And it's much better to do that care at the primary care at the clinic level than to try to recover from a more devastating condition. So,
tell me a little bit about, we've heard so much about this Housing First project that is looks like it's rolling along. Tell me a little bit about this, how the clinic will get involved with that project.
Sure. Now, the clinic has been a partner with the Housing First project, and the plan going forward is that the clinic will locate in the Housing First, and we'll be a tenant. We're not going to be a owner of the facility, but we'll be a tenant of the Housing First facility. So when the Housing First facility gets built, the clinic will have some space that is designed for the clinic at the on first floor of the Housing First facility.
Will there still be a part of the operation that would be downtown as well, or at that point it would be, or is that even known yet?
You know, at this point it would be hard to imagine having the resources to have two sites, but it's hard to predict what the growth needs would be and how we would kind of coordinate that. So at this point there isn't a plan for having a facility downtown and at Housing First, that we would just concentrate at one site. Having said that, if there's a need and there's the resources available to, you know, to have another satellite site, that, you know, would certainly be something we wouldn't, we'd look at that.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a little bit of future, you know, crystal ball stuff there too, but yeah.
And it's hard. The part of the reason for moving out of downtown is that, you know, rent is higher downtown than it is out in the Lemon Creek area, and you know, we are a we are operating at the edge of the dollars, so we have to be as careful with the money that we have as we can. So
yeah,
it's really important that we really look at all of our expenses and, you know, try to keep those as low as possible.
It seems, it's just from a, you know, layman's perspective, it seems like a lot of the homeless issue and a lot of the homeless people are congregating in the downtown area, though, so it makes so much sense to. So I'm sure that's been a point of discussion for you as you think about this new facility.
No, and that is a good point.
Yeah.
There is, you know, we do want to make sure that our patients have good access to the clinic, and being on a bus line is really important. And it is true that many of the homeless folks are downtown, but there's many clinic patients that live out in Schweitzer or in other parts of the community. And so, you know, we want to make sure that people have access to the clinic. And the Glory Hole is going to try to do a shuttle bus if they need to. And there'll be some other kind of tools that we'll try to use to make sure that downtown folks still can get to the clinic and make, you know, have access to their health care needs met.
Well, once again, it's the open house. It's happening in just about 45 minutes. Where exactly can people go if they haven't been to the health center before?
Sure. So the clinic is it's right downtown. It's very easy to get to, but it's a location not a lot of people know about. It's in the Mercantile Building on the upstairs, and it's if you know where Grumpy's is, it's right next to Grumpy's, the sandwich shop. So, and we'll be there. We'll have some non-alcoholic refreshments, and there's some art on the wall, and our new nurse practitioner, Cindy Matoni, will be there, and you can see what the clinic looks like and where it is, and And if you want to make a donation, that would be great.
No, it would be accepted, yes. Well, it sounds sounds great, and a great opportunity to welcome Cindy to town and welcome her to her to this newish position for her. I guess she's been there for a little bit, but yep. but an opportunity to see her. Carl, thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about the Front Street Community Health Center's First Friday open house happening at 4:30 today.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Here's a bird note.
This is Bird Note. We're crouching on a rocky shoreline of the Pacific Coast, hearing the piping call of the black oyster catcher, a stocky black bird with bright red eyes and a stout orange-red bill, perfectly suited for jabbing limpets and mussels. Let's listen again. A strong ebb tide's flowing, creating whirlpools and tugging at the kelp. On nearby rocks, harbor seals, looking like huge taut sausages, have hauled out to rest. If we're lucky today, we'll hear some snorting. The oyster catcher is completely dependent on this marine shoreline for nesting and food, even in winter, when waves hit these rocks with awesome force. Yet what seems like an inhospitable environment to us must offer some advantages to the oyster catcher. For one, wave-splashed mussels, the bird's chief food, open more often, making them easier to attack and eat. For another, when the monogamous black oyster catcher nests on ledges just offshore, its eggs and young suffer far less predation by mammals. Now that's something to celebrate. P.S. Contrary to their name, oyster catchers rarely eat oysters. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
Support for this station comes from the Treadwell Ice Arena, located at 105 Savico Road in Douglas. Treadwell Arena is now open for the 2015-2016 season with a 5-day schedule. More information at juno.org/parkrec/icerink or call 586-4540.
And welcome back to a Juno afternoon, where looks like numerous rain showers are in the forecast here for tonight. That's no surprise. But patchy fog late. Rain showers are happening tomorrow night. And then mostly cloudy with rain scattered on... Well, I'm not even going to go into it anymore. It's going to rain, okay? Let's just talk about rain. That's what's going to happen. Hey, with the studio now with me is Mike Norton. And also joining us is Tom Dawson, both of the Mendenhall Flying Lions Club. And thanks so much for coming in and joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
I need to make one quick adjustment here. There we go. Sorry. There we go. Now we're good. Thanks so much again for you guys for joining me. I really appreciate it. Tom, let's talk first of all about this fun event that's happening tomorrow. It's a barbecue.
Yes, that's correct.
And you've got a title that I want someday in my life, which is co-chair of barbecue. I love it.
Yeah, there you go.
So you got an event that's happening tomorrow. It's a barbecue. It's a fundraiser. And tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, we're having a fundraiser, barbecue fundraiser from noon to 5 p.m. at McGivney's Sports Bar and Grill in the Valley. And Randy's Rib Shack will be cooking up the ribs starting early in the morning. And then at noon, we start serving ribs, barbecued ribs, till 5 o'clock.
Now, I've already asked the secret ingredient to the sauce, but you don't know. Randy knows, and you don't even ask.
I don't even ask.
You know not to ask.
You got that right.
So tell me about what's on the menu.
Well, the menu is barbecued ribs, Randy's special barbecue, and beans and coleslaw. And Randy's Rib Shack will be cooking them up, and Super Bear will be providing beans that we put together in a big pot, and Food Service of America will be providing the coleslaw, and also the Alaska Brewery is donating a small keg for us, and we'll be serving Alaskan Amber for those who want a cold beer to go with their afternoon lunch.
I endorse that as an employee of Alaskan Brewing. I think that that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And so, Mike, tell me a little bit about who this whole thing's going to benefit. And,
well, this is the 20th year of our barbecue, and every year it's all the money that we raise goes to the American Diabetes Association. Some pretty staggering statistics that I'm going to tell you about right now, and that is that 56,000 Alaskans have diabetes. Mm. Every year, 2,000 more are diagnosed with it. According to the 2014 census, 3,400 people in Juneau live with diabetes, and 12,000 more have pre-diabetes, and some don't even know that they have it. The proceeds from this go to help the local nurses and health fairs and clinics. They get all the stuff they need to give to somebody who's diagnosed with diabetes and help them get through that. The one part of this that we really like a lot is Camp K. Camp K is a camp on Kenai Lake for 7 to 17-year-olds with type 1 diabetes.
And that's the early childhood onset diabetes is kind of the common term for that, right?
Yeah. A lot of these children will be having their blood tested every hour. Their diet is restricted. So they're pretty much one-on-one with a health professional while they're at camp, but they get to do all the things that kids get to do at other camps. It's 1 week every summer. If anybody wants to get more information on that, they can get a registration form online, ADA Alaska, or they can call 907-272-1428. This is a very good program. We do vision screening in the schools with a photo vision screener.
Oh, and is that an early indicator, or that's the sort of a first indicator that you can do?
Well, it can be, but what we've noticed is that there's kids that are coming into the nurse's office every hour, and deducing mm-hmm. what is going on, we know what's happening with those children. They're more than likely diabetic, and they're getting their blood sugars test. We ran into one little guy that had been to Camp K, and he thoroughly loved it and was just beaming about it. So it's a good program. Any child with type 1 diabetes can go from 7 to 17 years of age.
Is there a history with Lions Clubs kind of being involved in that and diabetes work?
Our club has been.
Uh-huh.
And, yes, other clubs around the world are too. In 1923, Helen Keller asked us to be Knights of the Blind, and that's our main focus, and diabetes can lead to blindness.
Mm-hmm.
So it all ties in mm-hmm. with what we're doing.
And let's just we got a couple minutes here. Let's talk a little bit more about other things the Lions Clubs do, other events that maybe are kind of what are some of the annual events that you guys
– On December 18th, the Mendenhall Flying Lions and Coastal Helicopters will be teaming up again, and we'll do the light flights over the valley. That's $30. There will be a limited number of people that will be able to go on that this year. We have to scale it back a little bit. It got
now, Flying Lions, I didn't put it together until you said that. Are most of the people in that, or did it start from that sort of, some pilots? Or?
Well, what it was there was a bunch of DOT workers
uh-huh.
33 years ago that were putting this club together, and they were flying all over the state. And that's how they did it.
I see. Okay.
So
they were just kind of road warriors.
There were maybe two pilots.
Yeah.
We don't have any pilots now.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was wondering.
That's we get that question a lot.
Yeah. So they were just road warriors kind of hitting a lot of spots in the state because of DOT work. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's cool. So that's December 18th. So mark that down, folks. You got 30. That's amazing What a deal, $30 to get over the valley and check out.
Yeah, you get about a 10-minute flight.
That's great.
And, you know, the people turn on their Christmas lights, and hopefully we get a clear, nice day.
Yeah.
Not blowing sideways.
Right, but, right.
It's a lot of fun, and it's fun to watch the little kids. You know, $30 get your little kid up on the helicopter. They come off of there, and their eyes are big, and they're grinning and ready to go again.
I have so many friends, even in Juneau, who've never even been on a helicopter, you know, and, you know, grown people who've never been on it. Yeah, you're right. It's such an experience to get up on one.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
$30.
I mean, yeah, that's right. Incredible.
Call it a Christmas present.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Any other things that are sort of coming up in the year to come?
Well, we do quite a bit. We do a bicycle rodeo with Shepherd of the Valley. We do litter pickup, food drives. We've done a couple for HUNA, the senior center out there. We sponsor a Boy Scout troop, Troop 247, and we ring the bell at Christmas time for Salvation Army.
And if I could add,
are you growing the beard for duty?
Yeah,
is that what's going on? Okay.
I started that back in 1971.
And if I could add, one of the things that we started just a couple of years ago is called Lands Packs for the foster kids. The Division of OCS Children's Services, when the foster kids are going from home to home, it's usually their belongings are in a big plastic bag, which is kind of demeaning. So we started Lions Packs, and once a year the community brings in all these little backpacks and things that we can put together for the children, and we've delivered that to OCS. So now they have a little backpack on their back that kind of gives them a little boost up, and there's a few things in the backpack to take care of it. And one of the things that really touched me was when we had this drive, the kids that would show up and bring some of their toys and stuffed animals to put in these packs, some of their very own toys that they brought that they wanted to give to these other children. So it was really touching to watch this.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, really. These kinds of efforts really bring out that community support, you know. But without the organization, it kind of doesn't happen.
Right.
Yeah.
We also recycle eyeglasses. There's a center up in North Pole, Alaska, called the Aurora Borealis Eyeglass Recycling Center, run by Lions, and we have boxes in all the eye care professionals' offices, and people drop them in there, and Juno should get a big pat on the back for doing that, because we just sent off 1,460 glasses, and we do that, we'll send that many twice a year.
Wow.
And those can be recycled. They clean them up, they categorize them, and then they can be recycled around the world, and Alaska is a state where we can recycle them in Alaska. So people can get a chance, if they can't afford glasses, they can do that. Mm-hmm. We also have a program where we assist people to get glasses, too.
If people are interested in joining up with the club, or is there kind of a way that people can get involved with the Lions?
Give me a call.
Yeah?
Give me a phone number.
957-1697.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're looking for people to help us out.
Right. I mean, with all these volunteer-type programs going all the time, I'm sure you're always looking for people that
can... Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
We have 10 to 12 active people here in town, and then we have other members that have moved away, but they still keep in our club.
Yeah. And that's just for the Flying Lions Club. There's also a downtown Juneau's club, so there's two clubs here in Juneau.
Yeah. And do you guys meet, like, weekly, or what are the meeting times?
Twice a month.
Yeah.
Right now we're in transition from where we're meeting. We're kind of floating around. So if somebody wants to come and see us or talk to us, they can give me a call at that phone number.
Or provide a place to meet.
Yeah, that would be good, too.
That's right.
It doesn't cost anything.
That's right. That's the key. Well, thanks for everything you guys do. Appreciate it so much. Let's talk one more time. Just give the details one more time about what's happening tomorrow.
Okay. The barbecue is tomorrow from noon to 5 p.m., and it's first come, first serve, and when we run out of food, that's it. And we will be ending and giving the bar back to McGivney Sports Bar and Grill at 5 o'clock, so they can get on with their regular business.
Yes.
So we want to thank them for allowing us to do this, and it's appreciated. And all the local folks in Juneau, we're looking forward to having you come out there and have a barbecue dinner and help out the ADA.
All right, all in support of Alaska and American Diabetes Association. It's the Mendenhall Flying Lions Club. Mike Norton and Tom Dawson, thanks so much for coming in and telling us about it. Have a great event tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for Juno Afternoon today. Thanks for joining me.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS, an excursion inlet in Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.com.